You have one unheard message.
Hi, I was calling Current, the influencer marketing platform, but I think I just got redirected to a bunch of people listening to a podcast. Well, anyways, I was calling Current because I was told they could help get my brand set up on TikTok Shop and even build out an affiliate program of content creators promoting my brand and even have those content creators go on live streams and promote my product there. Wow, I could really use Current. I also heard that the brands they work with are making millions in sales. I guess I'll just go to their website at current.tech.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
All rise.
Welcome to the Cyber Law and Business Report. Get the top story on the hot button internet legal topics of the day. This is your home for the latest on internet law and policy. Hear the latest net trends impacting business and have your questions answered right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report. Now, please welcome your host, the founder of the Internet Law Center, Bennett Kelly.
Good morning. This is Bennett Kelly. Welcome to another edition of Cyber Law and Business Report. We're broadcasting live here at the Internet Law Center in the downtown Santa Monica, the heart of Silicon Beach. Please be seated. We have a great show for you today, and we're talking with the author, Elisa Court, and she's the author of Squeezed, Why Our Families Can't Afford America, which National Book Review listed as one of five hot books and said it is a devastating report on middle-class American families struggling to stay afloat. Court eloquently relates these families' psychological and socioeconomic predicaments and amplifies these personal stories with research confirming significant and growing income equality. Elisa, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
And You start off right with a flurry of statistics and kind of like a quick going for a first round knockout to really make us alarmed about the state of a middle class today. There's a one of your opening paragraphs talks about why the anxiety exists in middle class is that it's now 30% more expensive than it was 20 years ago. In fact, in some cases, the cost of daily life over the last 20 years has doubled. And the price of four-year degree at public colleges, once a traditional ticket to the bourgeois, is now twice as much as it was in 1996. And then you go on with healthcare and homeownership. And it is really alarming, I think, the state of the middle class today. And what drove you to write this book was kind of your own personal state of alarm after having children.
That's right. I was a freelance writer, journalist, and so was my husband. And, we were fine when we were, before we had children, we had a rent-stabilized apartment. We had savings. But then after we had our daughter, suddenly we were in a whole other situation. We were paying for a lot of health care out of pocket. We were, suddenly having to pay for daycare and a nanny and figure out our future. And that led me to realize how many workers, middle-class workers like me, were now unstable professionally, economically. I started talking to my friends more openly about it. And then I started to report. I went out to the, around the country talking to, just dozens, almost 100 people about their experience, from lawyers to accountants to professors.
And there's this, one of the very first statistics after you talked about how life's becoming more expensive was education and how expensive that is and how, people are laden, being bogged down with debt. And, that applies not just to, your typical 20-something, But all these people who now, because of this disruptive economy, are going back to school to reinvent themselves.
Yeah, so I called that the second act industry. I actually wrote about that in the New York Times a couple months ago, based on the research I'd done in my book. I went to these second act job workshops, and one of them was very helpful. It understood that the people in their 40s and 50s that were trying to restart their careers after their professional lives were quote-unquote reimagined. That's a horrible word people are now using to describe being laid off in village. So their careers have been reimagined, and then they were in these, you know, second act job workshops. And this particular one that I went to was, they understood how emotionally draining it was and how much people blame themselves. And so they didn't kind of do this whole bootstrapping thing like, you can do it, you know, everyone can have a second act. Instead, they talked about, you know, going to sleep on time and, you know, writing a proper CV and just things that the people in the room had control over. But often you have now a whole kind of world of people who are benefiting from people looking for second act careers, you know, counselors, people running certificate programs, you know, for cooking or other kinds of, you know, mechanical engineering certificate programs, or there's anything you could imagine. Also for-profit graduate schools that are benefiting from the fact that people are having their careers reimagined later in life. And the result is often these people wind up in debt. You know, at least 17.5% of the trillion plus $1.5 trillion of outstanding student loan debt belongs to those over 50 years old.
Wow.
And this was over as of 2015. So by now, it's probably higher. And that debt is the money they're now taking on, having to get degrees later or feeling like they have to, or it's their own student debt, or it's the debt for their kids. So you're seeing just kind of a middle-aged middle class just swimming in debt.
Which is problematic. And you know, that means they can't consume, and you know, the middle class is often a driver of the economy. Now, if only these people were smart enough to go to Trump University, they wouldn't have a problem.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is the thing, and I return to this theme in my book. Like, it's weird, you know, our president, not in his presidential capacity, but just in his multiple business dealings and his television show, is really a representative of some of the things that are squeezing this population, these greedy and corrupt for-profit colleges and graduate schools, and these television shows that delude people, these reality shows delude people into thinking that it's 1% or bust, and, you know, that the very wealthy, you know, extreme lives are the lives that they should be leading or they could be leading, rather than, you know, trying to find kind of solutions, political solutions that can help them out of their middle class struggles. So I feel like, you know, he's hiding. He's like the Easter egg hiding in a lot of these stories, and not just as a president, but as a businessman.
I think that has to be one of the kindest analogies made about Donald Trump recently.
It's like the evil
Easter egg.
Orange, as somebody just wrote on social media hilariously, Halloween is a holiday where, you know, the pumpkins can be triggering of Donald Trump. Like, this is extremely funny. But yes, the jack-o'-lanterns.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, you go on. Yeah.
And so one of the things that really struck me was we talk about the growing expense and obviously education. And, you know, there was a time when, you know, there was a clear path, you know, especially for baby boomers, you know, at least earlier in their lives, that you go to college, you get your education, and then opportunity was in essence just handed to you. You had this booming economy that they graduated out to, and you know, a college degree meant advancement, you know, almost certainly. And whereas now, later in life, we're seeing these highly educated people in different industries struggling. And you go through some great stories, you know, adjunct professors, for one, journalists, which close to home, and then even lawyers, more close to home on this end. Why don't you tell us some of those stories?
Yeah, so I think the heart of my book is these stories, and you know, obviously, I intend them as illustrating the broader theme of how, you know, middle class and even upper middle class people get squeezed nowadays, but they're also unto themselves very moving and sometimes brave and inspiring stories. There is a woman that I followed. Her name was Bree, and she was an adjunct professor at a university out in Chicago. She lived outside of Chicago, and she was making low 20,000s after she had an advanced degree. She was teaching a number of classes, and at that point, she had a disabled son. And I had done some research on her experience and the experience of other adjunct professors. That means professors who don't have a regular tenure job or tenure track job. They're just part-time. They're now close to or the majority of professors in our country are adjuncts. And one study found that 62% of these adjuncts made $20,000. So it's, you know, below the poverty level. And yet they also have PhDs and masters, as Bree did. And Bree was also taking care of a disabled child. She's so smart and such a lovely woman. And, you know, she even by the end of the chapter, she started a charity for other people like her that was going to other people who were suffering. It was called Precaricore to help out precarious professors like her. And now one of the things about this book that was interesting is I followed people for many years. By the end of it, her life has been different. She got retrained, and in her case, it actually worked. She became started doing sort of work with disabled kids, speech pathology, I think, and now she has her first, you know, regular job doing that. And so, you know, it's not all misery and horror, but the number of years she had to go through in debt and fear, well-educated, hardworking, did everything right, and she still couldn't figure it out while her kid was, you know, suffering, was remarkable. And that's just one of just dozens and dozens of stories that you can read and squeeze.
And it's interesting. We also, when one of the other authors appearing at the book fair is Sarah Kendzior, who has the book The View from Flyover Country. And she talks about a professor, an adjunct professor, who taught for, you know, 20-some years at Duquesne University and was making only about $10,000. And mm-hmm. in fact, she was sleeping in her office because she couldn't afford any other place. And ultimately, she was fired at the age of 83 because they thought she was no longer effective. And, you know, she had cancer, and she died within months after that. And it's such a searing thought that here's this, you know, educated person, you know, just struggling to get by. And you tell a story of a professor, you know, who lives next to train tracks.
Yeah, this is that Professor Bree that I was mentioning, Bree Bullen. But, I mean, there was a story that was perhaps even more bleak of one of her acquaintances who was teaching also in Illinois at smaller colleges, a number of different ones, because universities and colleges try to, you know, limit the number of classes adjuncts can teach, you know, probably involving health insurance, right? And having, right. you know, to avoid them be. So then that means that they're, instead of it being a favor to them, oh, they're only teaching two or three classes, they're not making enough, so they're teaching at a number of different classes, and then they're commuting, and then they're covering those costs. So this is what this guy was doing. And he couldn't, you know, pay for his kids' ice cream sometimes, and he just wanted to give them piano lessons and ice cream. The guy had a PhD, he was teaching history. And, you know, some of the numbers behind this is, you know, really interesting. At least 28% of households that used food stamps in 2013 were headed by a person with at least some college education. And if we contrast that with 1980, that proportion was 8%. So you're seeing a rise in the education levels, but that doesn't necessarily mean that people are making enough to avoid needing, you know, assistance. And those with PhDs who received assistance, federal aid tripled, but in a three-year period that I, the three-year period I, in which I started considering writing this book. So, you know, that's what are these degrees necessarily doing for people? And it's more like, can we afford anymore to do what we love, to do these jobs that are, you know, about educating minds and, you know, teaching people civics and these kind of things. I mean, many of the characters in my book are people who are should be the backbone of society and should be stable, and they're not.
And it's funny. It reminds me of I was at a comedy club once, and the comedian was mentioning that he had a philosophy degree. And he said life was going great until GM downsized its philosophy department. But, you know, you have these educated people struggling. And, you know, when I was reading about the various adjunct professors, I mean, does that even – are they making a minimum wage even?
I don't know if they – we'd have to do the math on that. Probably.
Yeah, because you think of the prep time, the class time, and –
commuting. So I mean, you know, this is a whole other question. You know, if we have is fight when we're fighting for $15, is $15 enough? You know,
right.
And $15 an hour. Because I mean, but anyway, I don't. I'm not sure if we did the math that they'd be even making $15 an hour.
But you make a point that you think the universities, when you know the various U.S. News or who are, you know, there's also this cottage industry now of rating universities that, you know, they should take into account what percentage of adjunct professors there are and how they're being paid.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I came up with this thing called a fair labor standard in the book, and I've been researching it more, actually. And I know that I've now discovered that there's actually a group of professors that have been organizing around this issue and actually went to U.S. News and World Report and tried to get, you know, how adjunct professors are treated and how labor is treated, whether people can unionize at all, which is, you know, some colleges and universities, really, you know, fancy ones, they can't, have that be factored into how we rate the universities. Because you just think, like, everyone's worried about whether their coffee is fair trade, you know,
right.
And, you know, how comfortable their cow was before it was turned into a hamburger. Like, we're sending our kids to these colleges that can cost, you know, as I point out in the book, double what they did or triple or quadruple what they did in 1996. And yet, you know, they're being taught by people who are making potentially minimum wage and being terribly treated and without health insurance.
Which begs the question, where's the money going to?
You know, people say it's like administration. People say it's things like, you know, and I think this is right, you know, football stadiums and gourmet food, and but also like all these ways to kind of convince parents, because it's so competitive now, right, to recruit kids for schools unless you're in the top, you know, whatever it is, the top 20% of schools, then people go to great lengths, right? They'll have these fancy foods now, and, you know, there are colleges with high thread count sheets, you know, things that we would never have expected in the 80s and 90s. I know, right? It's actually
dang,
really
I'm going back to school.
Yeah, they sort of function like a, you know, they're like the standard. You know, yeah, so the money's going into things that we wouldn't really approve of. A lot of it's like, you know, look at Columbia University, places like that, probably UCLA. I don't know the situation, but I'm sure it's going, a lot of it's going to real estate. So it's interesting, but it is not going to the instructors.
And but one thing that we're going to be giving to is our advertisers. So we're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll have more on Squeezed with Elisa Court after these messages.
Stay tuned for more of the Cyber Law and Business Report after this brief recess for our sponsors. Do you look at the task of ranking your site at the top of the search engines like you would climbing the top of Mount Everest? It doesn't have to be.
TopSEOs.com knows how hard that climb can be, and they can make top ranking a reality. Top SEOs send you to only the right search vendors and agencies that they know will work for you. Since 2002, TopSEOs.com has reviewed and researched the best search engine marketing agencies and solutions providers. Don't risk the cost of falling off the proverbial peak of search rankings. Let Top SEOs give you peace of mind. TopSEOs.com, the independent authority on search vendors.
WebmasterRadio.fm is the destination for education, entertainment, and engagement. Engage with our panel of on-air experts and peers by following us on Facebook, Google+, Twitter, and LinkedIn. You can listen to WebmasterRadio.fm on air or on demand from our website or through iTunes, Stitcher, or however you get your podcasts. Interact and stay informed. Just search for WebmasterRadio.fm.
Are you looking for the best in WordPress speed, security, and scalability? WP Engine is a digital experience platform for WordPress, powering digital experiences for large brands around the world. With easy-to-use site management tools and powerful do-it-your-way development features, WP Engine gives you the flexibility to build it your way. Improve your SEO and conversion rates with a faster site on WP Engine. Learn more on WPEngine.com.
The best gavel-to-gavel legal news and information on the net is right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report, only on WebmasterRadio.fm.
And we're back, and we're talking with Alyssa Court, and she is the author of Squeeze, Why Our Families Can't Afford America. And this is being recorded on Halloween, and so you've already had at least one reference. And are you celebrating today?
I am. We're going as Little House on the Prairie family, Pa Ma and Laura Ingalls Wilder, even though I've discovered to my horror that she was really conservative and kind of jingoistic, had terrible attitudes towards the Native population. But my daughter is a Laura Ingalls Wilder fanatic, and so we have bonnets. Yes.
I wasn't sure that was still in the pop culture psyche, but I guess it's what, Nickelodeon or somewhere, TV land?
Well, yeah, we've been watching it and she reads it and yeah, so, yeah.
So, which actually brings us to another part of your book, there is no Little House on the Prairie chapter, but a big theme in your book is parenting. And the cost of parenting, especially for women.
Yeah, so for women, parenting, well, it depends. It's less parenting and it's more our experience in the workplace. I mean, we tend to be paid a lot less even than our childless peers, right? There was a study done that people said they'd pay women with children $11,000 less than women without children. And that's, forget men, and we're earning a whole lot more than all of us, right?
Right.
And that, you know, supposedly that even women who aren't, harassed for their pregnancies, which happens, it's gone up to something like, gone up by 269% the complaints to the EEOC about pregnancy discrimination as of late. But, our salaries can go down by 7% per child, according to a sociology professor at University of Massachusetts. And so, it's an unsparing social attitude that has economic and psychological ramifications. It experienced when we go to the job through bias, it's experienced when we're trying to get hired, and then it is experienced in our ordinary lives when we're trying to pay for daycare and balance the pressures on us while we're being underpaid.
And you make a good point, talking about how even if someone has been out of the workforce but engaged actively as a mom and managing all these different tasks and involved in the community, That gets about as much weight as the postage stamp on the cover letter.
Yeah, so you know we need to, you know, have a gender neutral hiring practices, right? Which don't, which would perhaps redact how many years people have worked or haven't worked, because that itself becomes a question. Or maybe get rid of the gender of the names, so there isn't bias in hiring in that way. Because that was something I actually wrote about in the book that has not got as much attention as I'd like, but. My first chapter was on pregnancy discrimination, and it was really striking. I mean, I talked to airline pilots who were not allowed to pump on the job and had a lawsuit around that, and I talked to a woman who was a discrimination lawyer who had herself been discriminated against when she was pregnant. She got pushed out of the law firm where she worked, and it filled her with this fury, and so she spent her whole career trying to defend other people who are similarly being pushed out. And I think the point with there is, yes, employers worry that women with kids or pregnant women work less. They're going to take, you know, unpaid leave. Oh, dear. You know?
Right.
But I think also there's a prejudice that once we are becoming caring and people, we're somehow not going to be good earners. We're not going to be as productive. We're not going to be as committed. And that somehow being, you know, sharp thinking and oriented to the bottom line can't coexist with caring for anyone. And this affects mothers who are employees, but this also affects caregivers, why caregivers are paid so badly, I think. And it even affects people like teachers. That is part of why I think teachers are paid so poorly. Because once anything is associated with care in this country, it is people are economically punished for it. For caring for vulnerable people. it's repulsive.
And one thing you mentioned, which, you know, there are a lot of definitely depressing statistics in this book.
Yeah, it's a little
and,
depressing.
You know, hopefully if it's sold in department stores, it's not near the razor blade section. But there's a part, and you mentioned that moms actually are more productive in the workforce.
Yeah, and I call this, I have a term for it, and this is happy. And by the way, yes, it is depressing, but I absolutely think it's uplifting, and I'm not just saying that because I want everyone to go out and buy Squeeze, but it's uplifting because of things like the motherhood advantage. I found the study that showed that they looked at the work of 10,000 women after they had kids, and they were much more productive than they had been before they had kids. And I also looked into the neuroscience and the social science, and there are different arguments around this where, you know, pregnant women are stronger than women who are not pregnant evolutionarily. And then there, you know, other great things can happen. Also, you can start to have leadership capacities after you give birth that you don't know you had before, partially because you're managing toddlers, you're managing children. This one scholar called these kind of minds, the minds that children have, open structures. So their minds are so different from yours and mine that, and yet we love them so much and have to deal with them all the time, right? That we become people who can handle lots of different kinds of people, more flexible in the workplace because of our relationship to our children. And I thought that was really interesting. Anecdotally, and when I'm talking to women for my book, they're better workers, they're more focused, they're more organized, their time is very compressed. I've gotten a hell of a lot more done personally since I had a child. I've written 3 books. I started an organization. And I just think there's a lot that we have to offer and that we're doing in the workplace, and we need to start recognizing that to fight back against the discrimination.
And based on that statistic and the stories you tell, maybe the nomenclature, you know, that which is so important, maybe instead of calling it family leave, we should call it a management boot camp. That would have a different resonance in the workforce.
That is so funny. I mean, somebody said to me, which I loved, like, the problem that I think I'm sketching out in this book is also the way that all of our lives are become work, right? Our home lives are work, or work seeps into them. You know, part of this is the digital, right? We're on the phone all the time, or the computer, right. Or we're, if we're doing low wage work, we're working strange hours into the night. I write about this in the book, and the terrible things that then happen when people have to work till 10 at night, moms and so forth. But what if the values of home seeped into our work life? What if we flipped the equation? And I think that's part of what, you know, you just mentioned, you know, the, you know, parental leave is boot camp, but it's like, yeah, what if the kind of familial intensity and the, you know, acceptance that we have to have of little kids and their difference from us is how we work, starts to help us work better rather than, oh, yeah, we're going to turn every single family into this hyper-efficient for this thing, which is kind of what's happening now, right? So.
Now, one thing you talk about is there's a chapter on Uber dads and just kind of this new economy and how people who got into careers that were supposed to be sustaining and give them the ticket to middle class life are now forced to do this. And I remember once when I had an Uber and the driver had been on a panel on women CEOs, and you know she was the CEO of a nonprofit. And you know, and she kind of was maybe awkwardly said that, well, I do this because I have a young kid, and this is my sanity check. I get to get out of the house and not have anyone screaming. But I think it's, you know, clearly she's ignoring the economics of it. And he bought a house in Park Slope, mm-hmm. and right before it took off. So now, you know, he's been able to. It was a tenement, so he's now renting that out and living on the island.
So do you do a lot of shows or?
Well, every week.
Every week.
This will be number 300 something.
My goodness.
What are we up to? Like 360 something. Oh no, three. This would be like three. This will be probably 318 or something like that. So. Okay.
Okay. Do you want to ask me the question just so I know what it is, or is that okay?
What was the question? The economic impact.
You're talking about the driver, the Uber driver.
Yeah. All right. So one thing that struck me was that you have this these people now who are in professions that they thought would get them to the middle class promised land and, you know, sustain them, you know, throughout their career are now having to work for Uber or do other jobs just to stay afloat.
Yeah, absolutely. So I write about these teachers, you know, on the West Coast near you actually, and in the Bay Area, who are driving Uber and Lyft, teachers aides at stop signs and traffic lights. They're thinking about grades and curriculum. They wind up inadvertently driving the parents of their students, which creates a funny service class moment where they're driving the parents and having conversations, discover that they have students in their classes. And they're doing this because they're not making enough money to pay for their mortgages and their rent. Sometimes they're making what would seem like decent money in other parts of the country, $55,000-$60,000, but in California right now or New York City, it's, you know, can be a real stretch.
Yeah.
So that's that. But what interests me is also the way it's affected people's sense of themselves. I think Uber has a campaign, or did in 2014 and 2015, you know, teachers driving our futures was the campaign, and it was for teachers, and there's one for nurses, that teachers and nurses were more valuable to a corporation as a symbol than teachers and nurses are valuable to us as a country. You know, we don't give them enough money or support or praise, you know, yet, you know, companies recognize that they have value, that people trust teachers and nurses. So that seems like a kind of dark parallel right now.
One thing that we value is our advertisers, and so we're going to take a short break. We'll be back after these messages. You're listening to Cyber Law and Business Report only on webmasterradio.fm.
Stay tuned for more of the Cyber Law and Business Report after this brief recess for our sponsors.
Content Marketing World 2018 comes to Cleveland, Ohio, September 4th through the 7th. Learn more at contentmarketingworld.com. Content Marketing World 2018 is the one event where you will learn and network with the best and brightest in the content marketing industry. Content Marketing World will have over 120 sessions and workshops presented by the leading brand marketers and experts from around the world, covering strategy, storytelling, ROI, demand generation, AI, and more. Leave Cleveland with all the materials you need to build a content marketing plan that will grow your business and inspire your audience. Save $100 off of registration using promo code RADIO100. That's radio and the number 100. Don't miss Content Marketing World 2018 in Cleveland, Ohio, September 4th through the 7th. Register now at contentmarketingworld.com. The Web Marketing Association is now accepting entries for its 7th annual International Mobile Web Award Competition. This award program is an opportunity for mobile developers to demonstrate their expertise in this growing medium. It recognizes the individual and team achievements of web professionals all over the world who create and maintain outstanding responsive and mobile websites and mobile applications. Deadline for entry is September 28, 2018. Submit your entry today at www.mobile-webaward.org. That's mobile-webaward.org. There are over 70 million active podcast listeners in the U.S. Webmasterradio.fm reaches them all with the largest global distribution of any online business-to-business podcast network. We can target and place your message in front of those active listeners immediately. Now, your message can be delivered with less commitment and investment on over 20 hours of weekly original content hosted by the most respected names in digital marketing, thanks to an exclusive private offer available for a very limited number of companies. But you must act fast. Email brasco@wmr.fm and get your message delivered now.
The best gavel-to-gavel legal news and information on the net is right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report, only on webmasterradio.fm.
And we're back, and we're continuing our discussion of Squeeze, Why Our Families Can't Afford America, and we'll be featured at the Miami Book Fair coming up. And we were talking earlier about, you know, people who were in careers that looked like they were going to get them to that middle-class plateau, but either because of the economics of the area they live in or other circumstances, just aren't quite getting there.
Yeah, they're not getting there for lots of reasons. I mean, they're not getting there because of the cost of housing, because of the cost of college and debt, as we talked about healthcare debt. And then they're also not getting there because wages are stagnant or relatively stagnant. And it's if you ever wonder, listeners out there, why is this not working out for me on the level I wanted? Why am I not doing better than my parents? And that was a question that a lot of the people in my book asked. They answered. They said, it's my fault. I'm doing something wrong. And this is a constant refrain, and a refrain in this book. And the reason I don't think it's all a downer is I'm telling the reader, it's not your fault. You know, in the 1970s, it was a sure thing that you made more money than your parents when you were 30.
90%, I think, right?
92% or 93%. Yeah. And now the odds are 50-50, only 50-50, of earning more than your parents. And that was according to a study by the Rod Chetty's Opportunity Project, Equality of Opportunity Project. And, you know, that's an objective set of numbers and data. So you can tell yourself this, you know, maybe it's not going to make you happy, but it's going to keep you from, you know, flagellating yourself when you wonder, why am I not doing better and I'm 40 years old, as many of the people in my book were asking themselves.
And that is the challenging period, because, you know, people at those age, 40, 50, there's this kind of vortex of all these things that are happening. Yet One is they're now expensive to their employers because they've been working 10, 20 years, and so the salaries are higher. They have higher health care costs, and so that's an issue. At the same time, their costs are increasing because they have housing, they have children now are about getting ready to go to college, and so everything seems to be coming at a point. And in the past, that would have been an area where they were most secure, and now it's actually becoming an area where they're most vulnerable because people are laying off people in their 40s and 50s because it's cheaper that way, or automation or some other means.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's also a head trip if I'm in my mid-40s. When I was a kid, all the people in journalism were in their mid-40s, right, or 50s.
Right.
All the people with any power and authority and experience. But now you go into newsrooms, and so many newsrooms are dominated by, as you're saying, really young people. So it's kind of a confusing thing that we were caught, I think a Generation X was caught, between the digital period and the kind of the golden age of some industries like law and journalism, right? And the security and the sense of ourselves, the prestige that we thought we might be easily obtaining now eludes a lot of people. And that's a psychological and existential thing as well as an economic thing, Why don't I feel secure? Why don't I feel like I've reached the pinnacle, in this midlife period, right? So, and that's the piece of it, psychological and existential piece, where I think knowing that this is a social or statistical reality rather than thinking that you've done something wrong can be very helpful.
And, I've unfairly harped on, the negative aspects in which you document, through stories and statistics. But to your credit, you end with the all-important question, what is to be done?
Right, and I do try to really address this. I mean, in many different theaters, do we embrace universal basic income, which is a $1,000 to $2,000 a month stipend for families that would offset the experience of, say, those adjuncts who were having trouble buying ice cream for their kids? That extra $12,000 to $20,000 a year would really make the difference for them. I mean, do we embrace something like that as a country? Do we try to, expand paid leave for families? I mean, that to me is a no-brainer. We have 14% of American workers with paid family leave and no national, paid leave, which puts us with 8 small nations, including like South Pacific Island nations. We're so behind the developed world in terms of pregnancy leave, maternity leave, subsidized daycare, pre-K. I mean, these are the things that we need to offer, and child care tax credits that aren't just $1,000, right, or $1,500,
right,
but are substantial. I also think we need to start thinking about ourselves differently, and this is with the psychological piece. We need to start having open conversations with each other about class and social class, about economics, about why we have a certain size house and somebody else is homeless and somebody else is
right.
Lives in a big house. Have those conversations with our kids. I had a great interviews with this group called Class Action in Boston, and I write about them in the book too, because they have these curriculum for parents and teachers and school boards and things like that to adopt ways of thinking about social class in the classroom, where, say, one kid would do a house swap for a couple hours with another kid and they'd be from very different parts of town, say, and that both kids would have an awakening about what it means to have a happy home, or, why one parent works with their hands and the other is works with money or whatever mm-hmm. have you, is an abstract kind of profession, and that it's not just a stigma. Class is not just stigma. It's not just the ladder. It's also a practice. It's a choice. For some people, it's a choice. Some of the people in my book, they may be being punished for it, but they became professors or teachers or lawyers because they wanted to, not because they couldn't flourish in the finance sector, say. So I think that's something that we need to have these open conversations with family members, with our colleagues, with other parents, I mean, one reporter who reported on my book made a, I think maybe it was an ironic line, but maybe it was for real. Why can't parents unionize? But I think, okay, we're not going to unionize parents. As my, and I jumped back when they asked me that. They said, we don't have time. We don't have time. Where would we meet? Where would we meet? In playgrounds? But, you know, I think that spirit, let's talk, let's communicate, let's try to organize for things like universal pre-K, but also let's, like, talk to each other about why we can't afford an after-school program, and maybe a group of parents can create one. And indeed, there are characters in my book who have done it, really imaginative stuff like this, barter and trade, where they trade housing for daycare with their neighbors, where they house sharing when they're not together romantically or biologically, but they share a house, they share meals, they share daycare. But I don't think those things would have happened if those people hadn't sort of come out, as it were, as being economically unstable and needing that. So, you know, these are the kinds of things that we can do for ourselves while the world burns, you know?
But, and so you have, I was looking at, there was one of the articles about your book, and there was a link to that showed the income distribution in cities in 1970, in a whole swath of cities, like 10, 1970, and then in 2015. And basically what was a middle class has now become, you know, the middle class was at one point the largest segment of the city, and now that's no longer the case. It's the, you know, it's the bottom two tiers that are now the largest part of the city. And how do we reverse that?
Well, you know, I mean, I think one way to reverse that is to get companies that are now moving into cities and upscaling them relentlessly to pay their taxes, right? I mean, the other thing is to sort of create not just affordable housing, but affordable kind of leases for shops to keep shops in areas that are not, so it's not just chain stores or the most expensive, you know, Hugo Boss or whatever. I mean, to try to keep local economies thriving. I mean, part of why you're having middle class leave is because they can't afford their rent, but they also don't even have, like, services locally for them, right? Everything's privatized, so they don't have what they need in places anymore, and they're being priced out, and that's just, it's left poor working people living further and further away from cities and commuting in, and then you have the wealthiest living in the center of cities,
right,
and kind of glamorous places. I mean, this is the side effect also of cities becoming safer. I think instead of moving to suburbs, sometimes people stay, and then they raise rents, and but really it's a, like, greedy, it's just greed, it's you know, relentless development of cities and trying to get my apartments in, say, New York City out of rent stabilization and rent control, not having those protections for them, making set-asides where you have buildings where one or two apartments are, you know, available for middle-income people, right? It's just not enough. Things that I've really appreciated were experiments on housing for teachers or municipal workers or firefighters. I write about some of them in my book, but, like, they did one in New Jersey, they did one in Illinois. You know, there's other places where because municipal workers can no longer afford to live in places like San Francisco. So you're
right,
working for the very city that you can't afford to live in. But what if there was housing for these people, kind of a distinct communities that are created for them? And they, teacher housing, that's another thing they've been doing, like in New Jersey. And that would be a way to also keep them from having to drive Uber, yeah. So,
right.
Uber's
but no,
stone.
But also, you know, they can live closer, because obviously if you're a teacher, you know, here in Los Angeles, a lot of people have, you know, drive an hour and a half just to get to work. And so if they're not driving 3 hours a day, they're definitely much sharper and, you know, can stay longer and be part of the community. You want that.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of what's missing from many of the people in my book wind up having to commute an hour and a half, 2 hours to their jobs, which is something, by the way, as I said, the working poor has done for a long time, right? Where it's a familiar story in, say, the New York City area, coming from the far reaches of Queens, as the daycare provider in my book does, to take care of a little kid in the center of the city, right? And I'm sure you can give an example from L.A., people living in, like, Vallejo and stuff like that, or is that,
yeah.
I'm forgetting, yeah, and commuting in to, you know, the fancy suburbs and whatever. But that is when you're, you know, trying to hold on to, like, a backbone of a city, like it's ordinary middle-class people. It's going to hurt the city to have all these people commuting. And another thing it does is it creates daycare needs that are really insuperable for a lot of families. I mean, you have people now, if they're living in these suburbs far away, you know, as one character in my book moves to Lancaster, California, further and further away from LA,
right.
You're paying for hours and hours of daycare when you're commuting. And that becomes another stress on families. So,
right.
Yeah, the whole commuting thing is just problematic top to bottom.
Now, you're going to be commuting to Miami, where you're going to be speaking.
That's a happy commute, my friend.
That is, unless it's a hurricane, but I don't think November is But you're going to be on November 18th, and you're on a panel, Real Life Economics, Readings from New Nonfiction. And so wish you luck on that. Are you coming out to L.A. at all?
I am. I'm so glad you're asking this. I'm going to L.A. I'm doing an event in Irvine at the University of California, Irvine. And I'm doing an event, a private event in L.A., and then I'm doing an event that's going to be open to the public with Capital in Maine, which is an organization, and I'm doing it with David Sirota, and I can find the address of that if you want. It's on the 27th of November.
Oh,
but the event in Miami is the Miami Book Fair presentation.
Right.
It's at 12:30 on Sunday, November 1st at Miami-Dade College Wolfson campus. So, and it's going to be
November
on Eastman,
yes.
too. It's going to be on November 18th. Oh, they wrote the wrong date here. Okay, November 18th, yes. 12:30.
That's great.
Yeah.
And if people want to follow you, because we're running out of time, if people want to follow you, what's the best way for them to do so?
Oh, absolutely. So I'm at LisQuart. That's my nickname, LisQuart. But they can also follow what we do at Economic Hardship Reporting Project. So that's economichardship.org. Or at Econ Hardship, that's the Twitter handle. So you can kind of get like a whole world view that way, and you see all the work that I've been doing there.
And part of you in that foundation, you work with Barbara Enright, the author of Nickel and Dimed.
That's right. And so, I mean, in some ways, I do see Squeezed as a bit of a continuation of Nickel and Dimed, like what would happen if we turn the gaze away from the working poor and to their middle class corollary, you know.
It's a very important question. I think it's created a lot of the anxiety that we've seen in the electorate, and it's going to get worse as, you know, I think baby boomers and the Generation Jonesers and Gen Xs start approaching retirement age, and they're nowhere ready to sustain themselves in retirement. And I think that's going to be a crisis that we're going to have to face. So the book is Squeezed, which is a great book to check out. And unfortunately, we're squeezed for time, so we have to say adieu. Thank you very much, Lisa, for joining us. It's been a great conversation. And so we have information on the author on our show notes, which are on our blog at cyberlawradio.wordpress.com. Check us out on Twitter at cyberlawradio. And as always, check out the Internet Law Center. We're a full-service internet law firm at internetlawcenter.net. Thanks again to Miami Bookfair for giving us this great author and these opportunities. And come back next week. We'll have more on the latest in cyber law and policy on Cyber Law and Business Report. See you then. Have a great week.
The opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and hosts and do not necessarily reflect those of WebmasterRadio.fm's management or sponsors. Any rebroadcast or redistribution without authorized consent of WebmasterRadio.fm is prohibited.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.